thank you for subscribing to Podcast One Premium.
Well, hello and welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. It's Tuesday and you're tuned in to Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tim, tonight we're going to talk about an interesting and creepy topic. I know we talk a lot about ghosts and we've talked about the demonic realm. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Bigfoot encounters and poltergeist. And one of the things that freaks me out the most is the idea of alien abduction. Now, I'm fascinated by the idea that we're being visited by other planetary beings or creatures from other galaxies, other dimensions, portals, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
To be watched and observed is one thing. To be abducted and experimented on, to have things implanted in your body, that gets into a whole new realm of weird.
It does, yeah, yeah.
And that's always been the most chilling aspect of the stories we've heard. And I often wonder what the long-term effect of these moments are because, you know, we've had Whitley Strieber on our show.
Right.
Right? And Whitley is considered to be one of the most famous abductees in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Or is he? He doesn't even seem to know.
Yeah. Doesn't he call him something like the Strangers or something like that now?
Yeah. And we just had him recently on the show a few weeks back, like I think our second episode when we were talking about black-eyed kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I thought was fascinating, all of a sudden his story is, oh, I've never really had any bad encounters. And I said, Whitley, I thought they were pretty abusive to you. Well, yeah, up front, yeah, they were really horrible. But after that, I mean, once you get past the rape and the molestation, yeah, they're fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems like he's, I don't know if he's come to terms with it. I don't know if he's just found peace with what's gone on and through the years maybe has educated him on himself and that he realizes that when it first happened it was terrifying because it was new. Or has he got some kind of Stockholm syndrome where he's so used to these beings and the abuse and the weirdness that they put him through? Now there's the other side of the coin, and I'm going to address it because many people have addressed it to us since we've had him on the show a few times.
Okay.
He'll be the first to tell you he can't even call them aliens. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
He doesn't know what it is. Now, he's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He has a very vivid and active imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And he won't even go officially now on the record and call them aliens. He'll say he referred to the Greys a few times, I think, on our last interview and talked to them as the Strangers and the Visitors and things like that. But he's very noncommittal to what he thinks happened. And he even said, which I found weird, is that he can't even be sure that he fully had like the experience. So I don't know how much of this was like in a hypnagogic or hypnopompic state,
mm-hmm.
how much of this was hallucinated or very vivid imagination. I don't know because I really don't understand the way he vacillates. I think on our first interview, even speaking with him, Tim.
Yeah.
He came out of the shoot talking about this experience and how weird it was.
Right.
And then he kind of downplayed it halfway through. And then I think I poked him again during that first interview about the situation. You know, well, did you ever feel like you were in danger? Yes, they raped me. They raped me. And all of a sudden he took on this totally different attitude. And it was all in the span of like a 1 hour interview.
He got angry.
Not at us, yeah, but at them, at like
situation.
Reliving it.
Yeah, the situation.
I don't understand it. So maybe the best thing to do is talk to somebody who does understand the situation. Somebody who is considered one of the world's leading experts on alien abductions. Daryl Sims is joining us this evening. His 38 plus years of field research has focused on physical evidence, led to his groundbreaking discoveries of alien implants and alien fluorescence. Now, as a former military police officer and CIA operative, Sims has a very unique insight to the alien organization, which he believes functions similarly to an intelligence agency. We're going to welcome him to the show tonight, maybe get some understanding. Is this something we should be afraid of? Is it something that our government or our world has control of? Let's find out from our guest now, Daryl Sims. Welcome to Beyond the Darkness.
Thank you, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
This is certainly a topic that polarizes people. They either completely believe that we are being visited and people are being abducted, or the other side of the spectrum is people just shut it down immediately because it just sounds too fantastic to be true. I'd like to know if we can...
That's true.
If we could start back in your history, were you a believer throughout your life that aliens existed and UFOs and interplanetary beings, or was that something that you got indoctrinated into later in life?
Well, I wouldn't call myself a captive audience.
Okay.
Excuse me. I didn't have any clue as to what an alien was or anything like that, and I'm still convinced to this day that we still don't yet know completely who they are. I'll give you some pretty good answers, I think, today for your audience. But the bottom line was that I was 4 years old in 1952 when the event started, and I had no clue what in the world an alien was. My parents didn't let me watch monster movies. I'm not even sure there were any when I was 4 years old in 1952. So it was just a complete shock for me, the thing to come in the room and to be there, and it just, none of it made any sense to me.
So you were 4 years old?
That is correct.
Please explain to us what happened that first time. What did you witness?
Well, what I witnessed was, and I'm giving it to you from the kind of the end of the story, and because I know a lot more about it now, because I've been able to piece this together over the years. But basically what happened is the entity had just dropped me off in my room, and I was I woke up at the wrong time, so to speak. I opened my eyes. I realized something's wrong, and there was this entity walking away from me toward the wall. And he was pure white, real skinny, spindly, large, bulbous head. And I thought to myself, well, what is that? And he's going to bump into the wall. I had no clue he was going to walk through it. So I couldn't figure out why he was walking toward the wall. And as soon as I thought that, apparently he could hear me telepathically, I guess. And he turns around, and the weirdest part of this whole conversation is that I could hear him think just like he apparently was hearing me think. And he said, "It's awake." And I realized he's talking about me. So I wasn't supposed to remember anything, apparently, and many people back in those times didn't remember much of anything. The programming that was done then was quite effective, and there was certainly no place to turn to, like your program as an example, to vet this sort of thing or throw it out there and see what would happen. There just was no such creature, no way to talk about this, no vehicle to inform people. So I never told my parents, never told anybody anything, and kept it to myself. And over 13 years, from age 4 to age 17, the events continued, and they stopped violently at age 17.
Can you explain to us what these...
And that was my total business with them.
What did the beings look like to you? Or was there a myriad of different characters that you came into contact with?
Well, the first one was simply this skinny, little white, spindly little being that about 4 foot tall or so. Of course, to me, he was pretty big because I was a pretty little guy. And the amazing thing to me was when he turned around and looked at me. At that point, I was really stunned because he had large black eyes, but they weren't the Hollywood version, the wraparound elliptical eyes you see in the movies. His were perfectly round, 100% round, about the size of a big silver dollar. And it made no sense to me. And, of course, kids see things differently than adults tend to do. I mean, the guy's standing there, and it's wintertime. I'm cold, you know, and I'm covered up with covers. And he's standing there with no clothes on. Well, the first thing a kid looks at, if you're, you don't have any clothes on, they look to see what you look like.
Right.
And he didn't have any TT. He didn't have a belly button, and he didn't have any nipples or mammary glands. I mean, none of this made any sense to me. Why doesn't he look like me? Of course, after 38 years of investigating, I finally put together a few things. Number one is, if you don't have genitalia, you don't reproduce. If you don't have a belly button or a navel, you weren't born. You're either hatched, cloned, manufactured, or made. And I think that's the better answer for how he got here, so to speak.
So it began at 4. You have no memory of what that first meeting was like. You just remember being dropped off. And how often?
I remember being dropped off, yeah.
Right. How often did these encounters take place going forward?
There were about one a year or thereabout. It seemed to happen about 10 events over a period of 13 years. Back then, I never made the correlation as to, you know, but I never put these things together. I never strung them together, so to speak, like beads, and made sense of it. It just something weird that strange had happened, and I never would tell my parents. I was so upset that night, the next morning, that my parents kept asking me, what happened? What happened? You know, why are you upset? And I couldn't tell them anything. I knew they'd never believe me. And you're instructed also by these entities to keep quiet, not to tell anybody. And so that night, the next night, my parents put me between them to sleep, and which was really unusual because they just didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I had my own little tiny room. And I again felt something really weird wrong with that picture, and I opened my eyes real quick when I was laying between my mom and my dad, and there was the same entity at the end of the bed in their room where I was sleeping, and another entity right next to him. And this is the weirdest part of it. They looked exactly alike, but I could tell them completely apart. Now, how that happens, I have no idea. But I knew that guy right there was my caretaker, so to speak. He was the one that was in charge of me, and the other guy had no idea who he was or why he was there, but he looked just like the other one. And I took my little elbow, and I kept hitting my dad as hard as I could. He was laying on his right side. I kept hitting him, I hurt my little elbow on his spine because I kept hitting him so hard trying to wake him up. My dad's a light sleeper, and my mom couldn't wake up, it was just really bizarre, I just never could get them awake. And the next thing I know, I'm gone, and here we are again at another event. But that's very unusual for an event to happen two in a row on the two nights in a row. That's just very unusual.
When you said then you were gone again, do you remember them taking you and where they took you?
I remember them taking me, but I don't remember much of what they did or what was involved. I pieced together some other things from another event. During that same time, within a year later or so, I was taken when I lived in Mayhill, New Mexico, which is the middle of nowhere. And we had actually had an outhouse back then. This was back in the 50s. We had a little outhouse there until we got our little house built and a little outdoor bathroom, so to speak. And I went out to use the bathroom that night. And when I opened the little door to the outhouse after I came out of it, I started to close the little door. And there was this entity, the same one, standing there waiting on me again. And boy, I mean, I was scared beyond, I was mortified. It was night, and here he is standing there, you know, in the moonlight with his bright white skin, if that's what it is, with those large black eyes. And the next day, they brought me back, but the next day I did something really unusual for me, because I've rescued animals my entire life. I love animals. I like insects. I like everything. And the next day after school, I'm out there killing grasshoppers. I mean, hundreds of them. There are lots of them out there in the weeds. And I can't that I can't kill them fast enough. And it finally, I picked up one of the grasshoppers and looked, got his little face right next to mine to kind of look at, why am I doing this? What is wrong? I'm in the third grade at this point, and I just barely went into third grade, and I'm shocked because I can't figure out, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. And as I get him real close to my face, I realize that's the wrong insect. It was a praying mantis I remembered. The large praying mantis face, a 7-foot-tall praying mantis, was the one I was upset about from the event the night before.
So you were, and for our listeners that aren't familiar, and we've heard quite a few of these type of encounters over the 12 years we've been doing the show, there are these beings that look like giant praying mantis. In most cases, though, I've heard the face is very praying mantis, but the rest is almost like an electric kind of body. I don't know how else to explain it. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me, but I have 1,800, and that's not true. I have 1,900 cases now worldwide. And in fact, I just came back from India from a work I did there in the UFO field. And so I know a great deal more about this than just anecdotal information. Mm-hmm. Number one, being a witness. And number two, looking at evidence from as a former police officer, looking at it from other points of view. And the main thing that I can say about that event, about the alien period, for your audience, I think to make this a little clearer for them, is that there are 7 primary models, and I use the word model. Other people call them 7 races of aliens here on Earth, visiting Earth, doing whatever. Mm-hmm. In my view, after 38 years of investigations, the testing and DNA and other visual evidence we have seen personally and otherwise indicates that these are not 7 races of aliens. The little gray is one, is an example. The taller one that looks just like him, but he's a lot smarter. It sometimes people refer to as the doctor. If somebody's going to cut on you or do something like that, it's going to be him. He's about 5 foot tall. The little guys are between about 3 to 4 foot tall. Then there's this mantis-like being who's extremely intelligent, probably got an IQ about 180. And then there's these humanoid types, which some people refer to as the Nordics, or these blonde-haired human-like beings. But the fact is there are red-haired ones and dark-haired ones as well, not just the blonde-haired ones. And then there's this Bigfoot-like creature that I think is part and parcel to this whole show. He's just another model that was made, hatched, cloned, or manufactured and brought down here for the purpose of convincing people that we're interacting with aliens, quote unquote, from another planet.
Oh, they were created to convince us that we were dealing with something like this?
That seems to be the story.
Okay.
I spent two years in the intelligence community as well in the Central Intelligence Agency during when I volunteered during the Vietnam War. And what I have found after my investigation along this phenomena is these entities are very secretive. They're very non-cooperative with us, so to speak. And they want everything from you, but they won't tell you anything. And when they do tell you things, they tend to lie. Well, this is pretty much the way cover stories are developed with intelligence communities. They have an operation going on, and they won't tell you the truth of it. They'll make up a story, a whopper, or give you disinformation about it so that you won't ever know what's really going on. And that's very common in the intelligence business. But when I got out of the intelligence business and I looked at the UFO phenomena, I realized, my gosh, they're doing the exact same things that we did. And they function very much like that. Mm. And if you look at the entities I was drawing, I called the usual suspects. And it's a lineup of these entities. And when you look at them and just look at them objectively, not as aliens or anything else, but just these little bipedal creatures, some of them being 8-9 foot tall, that Bigfoot character is an illustration, and ask yourself some basic questions. When you look at the humanoid, you say, well, where in the world would aliens or anybody get human DNA? Probably planet Earth. Where would you get, if you look at the Bigfoot, he's obviously a simian or an ape creature of some kind. Where would you get ape DNA? probably from planet Earth. And you look at the praying mantis and you say, well, I wonder where in the world you'd get that kind of DNA. Well, it probably isn't from Saturn or Jupiter or any other place local. The cosmic Walmart's DNA store is planet Earth. And I suspect that what's happened is someone has come here, taken certain DNA from our planet, hatched, cloned, manufactured, or made these entities for the purpose of interaction with us to convince us that they are, in fact, from other worlds. But the real question is not that. The real question is who made them and why the ruse? Why are we hiding all this stuff?
Daryl, let me ask
a remarkable. Yes, go ahead.
If I could ask you a quick question, please, and take no disrespect to this, but have you ever had yourself psychologically checked to make sure that this was not just machinations of an imagination or a brain gone haywire? And again, please, I mean, no disrespect in that, but I know that a large portion of the audience would be curious about that as well. Have you ever been evaluated for mental illness?
Well, of course. And we do this with some of our abductees as well. When CNN came to my home for 3 days, two of our abductees came forward, and these are professional people, and they told about their abduction encounters. And one of them was when he was a little boy, he would be taken. He and another little boy would be taken in one part of Houston, and they were missing all day. And later in the evening, when this happened several times, the police would finally find these two kids clean across Houston somewhere. These kids are 3 and 4 years old. And, of course, they were thinking somebody kidnapped these little children and tried to harm them. But they never described that. The only thing they ever described was the alien being over and over and over. And when CNN was there talking to me about this and interviewing these people, they said, well, we think they're probably with some mental aberration or something. And I said, well, I actually have a psych report on these people. I brought it with me. And I said, and again, I told them the same thing. No disrespect to you. Do right. you have one on yourself?
Right.
And I said, first of all, I said, you're accusing these people of being possibly mentally ill or whatever. I said, what qualifications do you have medically or psychologically to evaluate anyone? And of course, they said none. And I said, well, then that kind of leaves you out in the dark. I said, because their medical report said there's absolutely nothing wrong with them whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And Dr. John Mack, professor of psychiatry, chief of medical psychiatry at Harvard, who studied this as well, found that in many of the cases, and I knew him personally before he passed away, stated that many of the abductees that he had talked to, the vast majority of them have absolutely no psychopathology that would suggest that there's anything wrong with them. That they, in fact, have had extraordinary experiences that we simply can't explain.
Well, and you understand where, I mean, as a researcher in law enforcement and working for the CIA, you understand where the need is from people like myself to ask that question, because we want to try to make sense of what we're hearing. And when it seems to fit outside of our white picket fence and perfect little cupboard, people want to understand there's got to be a mental issue or mental deficiency. And it's important to know that these people have been tested by experts whose job it is to understand if there's a mental issue going on. And that's why I think it's important when people are telling their story as well. You've got somebody who isn't dealing with a mental breakdown or wasn't dealing with, issues of paranoid delusion. They're actual, fully functioned human beings that are just having extraordinary experiences. And
no question about that. And I was evaluated even when I was in the Central Intelligence Agency before they gave me a top secret clearance. I had to have a clean bill of health in every sense of the word. They're not going to spend, back in 1968, $250,000 on a background check on you to find out that there's something wrong with you. There were many other things they did before they were going to spend that kind of money.
Were you forthcoming with your information at that point, though, as being evaluated for the CIA, being evaluated as military police, that you believed that you were having encounters with alien beings?
Well, my encounters had ended some time before that, and I've not had anything further happen, and they never asked anything concerning that issue. However, I will freely admit this, that the fact is that the intelligence community has for some time been evaluating and been involved in the UFO phenomenon itself. In fact, hundreds of thousands of pages have just been released, I think it's this year, on UFO evidence from the Central Intelligence Agency, the FBI, and other files, just literally droves of them. And no one's had any time to literally go through these things. But the fact is that there is a massive evidence from them of their own investigations, what they've done. The fact is that the DSP satellite system, which is, these are, at the time when I first started this, were 19 geosynchronous satellites that can look basically at, so to speak, you hear the old story about they have satellites that can literally look at, read your watch if you're still.
Right.
And if the satellite's pointing, that part is not even classified. That's obviously true.
Right.
They're much more sensitive than that. The point is that some of the people that we have that are abductees that I've worked with in some of these 1,900 cases around the world, a number of these people are, in fact, two of them are NASA scientists, currently still employed. And no, they're not telling NASA what they saw and what happened to them. It's not going to happen.
Got to wait for that pension to clear.
Two DSP satellite specialists that are the same way, and they're just never going to tell this stuff. No.
Daryl, can I ask you one question here real quickly? We have to take a break in a minute, but you mentioned all of these new documents that have been released, and I hear about this all the time, and Canada's released, and France is released, and America's released, and I read through them, and most of it's garbage. There's really nothing more than these reports came in. They don't really weigh in one way or another if it was a craft or if it wasn't a craft, what their beliefs are. I mean, I can go online and read people's testimony. Does it make it any more credible just because the government released it? Usually I would think they'd release the crap in their files that meant nothing and they didn't deem a security risk. So if they're releasing it, is it really anything of import, or is it just what they deemed was the garbage that they didn't need to keep anymore?
Most of the time, the things that are released by the intelligence community, mm-hmm. and this is a pretty standard operating procedure, most of the things that are released in any subject is the least important and stuff that's not going to get them in any trouble. They're not going to be accountable for that, so to speak.
Right.
But among the DSP satellite specialist is an example. The term fast walker and slow walker has a very distinct meaning. These are UFOs that move very quickly and very slow. And what that simply means to perhaps you and I is that these are UFOs that are watched by these DSP satellites, and they appear in the infrared, ultraviolet, and even sometimes in the visible range as well, but they're still notable and still you can still see them with this particular satellite equipment. It seems to me that that if they're spending this type of money mm-hmm. and this type of intelligence exploiting and looking at these things, and they will not. In fact, when I interviewed one of these satellite specialists, who was an abductee, by the way, and asked the question about UFOs, he said, there are no such thing. There are no flying saucers. He said, nothing like that exists. He was very emphatic about that. And he looked at me and smiled. He says, there are fast walkers and there are slow walkers. There are no flying saucers. There never have been. And what they're doing is they're trying to code that so they can never be accused of saying that they believe in flying saucers or anything like that. He said the fast walker and the slow walkers are, in fact, craft that exist in our atmosphere that are not us, that are not the Russians, or not anybody that we know of. And he said they can actually go into infrared and ultraviolet ray levels as well. That's why they so-called disappear. They're just moving to another light spectrum, which would be invisible to us, either UV or infrared.
It's fascinating that you mentioned that. I had an aspect of this, and I've talked openly on the show about my adventure at James Gilliland's UFO ranch out in Trout Lake, Washington. And on the second time I was there with two of my dear friends, I wanted them to see what I had experienced and how active the skies were. There were two things that stood out to me, and this was during the daytime, Daryl. You talk about how they're hiding in these different light spectrums. You know, we've often heard that alien craft will hide in cloud formations, especially lenticular and so on. And it's, you know, to me, it sounds silly, but I guess if you're going to conceal yourself in a cloud formation would be the best way to do it. And I actually have a photograph of this I've posted from time to time. I had to laugh because when we got there, over the property was a perfectly formed 1950s saucer shaped UFO. Cloud. It was a cloud. It was like it had the dome top and then the outside saucer look to it. It was funny. And I was standing there laughing with my friend. And I said, Kim, I said, look at this. That's got to be the stupidest alien in the galaxy to hide in a UFO shaped cloud. And we both kind of laughed about it, obviously not believing that there was one, when suddenly this black ball began undulating and dipping out of the cloud. And it was like looking at the humps of the Loch Ness Monster bobbing in and out, and it would go up in the cloud. And I looked at it and I said, what the hell is that? And we were kind of laughing, astonished. But then the sky, it was a beautiful, God, it was gorgeous, beautiful blue sky. Very few clouds. I mean, there was some cloud cover, but not like thick clouds. But it was this beautiful blue sky. And as I'm looking up in that area, suddenly all I can say is it was kind of this pinkish ribbon of energy started moving, almost like you're looking at the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, the way you can see that flickering of the green fire as it, you know, leaps into the sky. There was this pinkish and orange pattern of energy that rolled overhead, and it kept waving back and forth like you're watching the waves crash against the shore. And I said, I looked at my two friends. I'm like, holy shit, what is that? What is going on up there? And my one friend looked up and didn't see it. The other one's like, that's amazing. And I said, what are you seeing? She said that ribbon of energy just moving through the sky. But my third friend did not see it, did not witness it. But the two of us did. And you're talking about hiding in this other visual spectrum. This thing I saw, I called it the glitch in the matrix at that time, because I thought if there really is something like that, this is it, because I'm seeing the glitch in the matrix. I'm seeing the light pattern screwed up, but it appeared as though something was moving underneath the layer of the sky. And it still stands today as one of the most remarkable things I've ever witnessed.
That is an amazing story. And I'd like to add one to it. One of my investigators is he's an attorney, and I can't tell you how high up in the government he is, but he's a big attorney, and he does investigations on his own privately and keeps this stuff pretty quiet. And he sent me this case. It was rather fascinating. He said, Daryl, this guy isn't the city attorney. And I said, okay. And he said he sees this triangular craft outside of his house, and so do other people in the city. Mm-hmm. And he grabs his wife and says, let's follow that thing around, find out some things about it. And she said, are you nuts? And he got her, put her in the car anyway, took off with her.
Sure.
And he said, the reason I'm telling you this story is because I know you, the only cases you deal with are physical evidence cases. And he said, there's a lot of evidence in this case. So they follow this thing around, and it gets late at night, and then it's cold, it's winter, and then all of a sudden their car quits working, and the next thing they know, they've called the wrecker guy to come pick them up, and they told the wrecker guy, boy, you sure got here early. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, we just called you a minute ago, and he said, that was 3 hours ago when you called. So they've got missing time here for 3 hours. Their windows are rolled down. It's midwinter, and they're not even cold.
Hmm.
One explanation for that is they just got back into the car. Somebody just dropped them back off.
Right.
And the wrecker guy finally shows up. They see the wrecker guy showing up. They put him back in there. Anyway, they relay this experience. He actually wrote an actual report. Now, this won't get you reelected. Wrote a real report as to what happened to them. I mean, as credible as any two people you ever want to meet. And he also noticed his watch was messed up. And so he said, well, I got to get my watch fixed. So the next day he goes down to the watch repairman, hands him his watch. He says, what's wrong with my watch? He said, he quit last night at 10:30. Well, that's when the event happened. That's when it started. And the repairman took the watch apart, the jeweler, and he said, your watch has been completely melted from the inside out.
Wow.
And I have the watch, and I have the evidence of that. And, of course, for me as an ex-police officer, my interest is not did the aliens do that, but how can I duplicate that? How can I, if I wanted to make a fake case out of this, what would I have to do that?
Right.
And so that's what we're looking at next. But so far, based on everything that we've seen thus far and the credibility of the witness, and so on, like I said, if the attorney, the Harris County attorney turned in a report like that, it's not likely that people want to be voting them back in. The fact is that the individual is that honest and was just profoundly struck at the contact case that they had. So we've got more than just so-called housewives and little kids disappearing and things like that. My interest is in physical evidence. And for your audience, what that means is that I look for evidence on people and in them.
We got to take a break, Daryl. That's a good place to leave it. We'll come back. We've got more coming your way. Do us a favor, folks. This is pretty amazing. We've got a way for you to help us. Everybody keeps reaching out. What can we do to help Beyond the Darkness grow? What can we do to keep you guys on the air? We love the show. We've got so many great new listeners and supporters checking in. We've got something for you. It costs absolutely no money to you, but it's a great way to show your love and support for Beyond the Darkness. Go to podcastone.com. Find the Killer Deals link. Click on that link right there. Then you'll scroll down till you find the Beyond the Darkness banner. Click on that banner to visit all of our advertisers. So as we begin to grow this show, we get more and more advertisers. The more you support the advertisers on the show, the better we will be able to do and the longer we'll be able to stay on the air. But Dave, you just said it's not going to cost us anything. If we're going to go hang out and check out your advertisers, that means we're spending something. Well, here's what I do want to tell you. One of the things you can do is click on the Amazon links there. You're going to buy from Amazon anyway. It's the largest shopping mall in the world, and everybody uses it. So why not, when you use it, help your buddies out? It costs you no extra money. If you click that link, bookmark it, save it, and every time you go make a purchase from Amazon.com, one small percentage of that sale is actually going to help us, and it costs you nothing. If you went to regular old Amazon.com to buy it, and it was $20, you go through our link, and it's $20, nothing comes out of your pocket anymore, but a little small percentage comes back to help Tim and Dave so we can continue to bring you top quality guests, top quality show, and continue to keep the show alive. That's all I'm asking. Check out our advertisers, and if you see something that fits for you, make sure you visit our advertisers, spend a little money with them, but you know you're going to go through Amazon.com already. Why not just do it and make it work for us? Now, I have another thing that I need from you guys. When we put out the call on Twitter and Facebook and we said, we need your support. We're 1 hour a week on Podcast One. I said, can you send in an email? Just let them know you'd like more darkness. They expected to get 20 to 30 emails that week. They got 150 emails in the first hour. They had over 750 emails in the first day. They stopped counting at around 1,500 emails in the first 24 hours. That's the power you guys bring. Well, we need a favor from you. You got to help Beyond the Darkness stay free to download with very minimal ads. Responses for this will help align the appropriate advertisers to our audience. So the survey is short. It's completely anonymous, and it takes no more than 5 minutes. We've had you guys help us out when we asked for emails. You came in droves. Thousands of people came in droves and responded. Help us out here. Let's overwhelm them with the amount of Beyond the Darkness listeners that can go in and do this quick 5-minute survey. There's two easy ways to participate in the survey. You can go to podcastone.com/my survey. That's podcastone.com/my survey. Or go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner. If you filled out a survey for us in the past, we thank you, but we still need you to do this again. You do all of us here at Beyond the Darkness and Podcast One a huge favor by filling this out. So thank you very much for supporting our program and taking the time to complete the survey. It means a lot to Tim and I. Again, this is not a survey about your thoughts on our show. It is specifically designed to gather information about the type of listeners we have on the show. So if you could do that, it takes 5 minutes, completely anonymous. We'd really appreciate that. Just go check out podcastone.com, click on the survey banner, and make a difference for us on the show.
Beyond the Darkness.
And we're back here on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave Schrader, and that's my abductee over there, Tim Dennis. Yeah, you're my abductee, Tim.
They keep finding me, though.
Well, yeah, I keep abducting you and making you do the show. That's part of the deal. Yeah. Talking with us tonight is Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, one of the world's leading experts on alien abductions. And aside from being an expert on this, he is a very compassionate and skilled therapist who has helped hundreds of alien experiencers all over the world come to terms with what they've witnessed. And he's done a lot of work with implants. Before the break, we were talking about physical evidence. Things that you can physically see that will be able to, back up some of these claims, substantiate some of these stories. And we had to cut you short to go to the break here, Daryl, but thanks for hanging in with us a little bit longer. What, in your opinion, is the best type of physical evidence to prove that these abductions and that these visitations are actually occurring?
Well, one of the things that would be most important to me as an investigator and an ex-cop is to have physical evidence of the craft. The second thing I would want would be evidence of the entity itself. And third is the evidence inside an abductee alleged that, in fact, they've had some type of contact and that the evidence inside them found was not natural to the human body and, if possible, was extraterrestrial in origin. Those three things would be immensely important to me to substantiate a person's case.
Well, you talk about physical evidence of the craft. I mean, it's not like they left their bumper torn off and it's, my other car is a UFO bumper sticker on it to let you know that that's what's there. What do you mean by physical evidence of the craft itself? Are pieces of it, scorch marks, radiation? What are you looking for?
I've investigated the scorch marks, radiation tracings in the Sedona area. I've found one individual shot a UFO. Some redneck went out and just saw this UFO with a light on it out there on the ground. You have to laugh at some.
Yes.
And he didn't know what it was. They're out in the woods and not far, near their home, but there's no one around. And like, who is that? And what are they doing with that big bright light out there? And he keeps yelling at them, and they never would respond. So he fired his shotgun, and you hear the BBs bounce off this thing, and then all of a sudden his craft goes zooming off into the air. Well, 2 years later, during the snow, I went out there with a radiation detector and found BBs inside the tree that apparently bounced off of that craft and had a radioactive trace on it, small radioactive trace, which that was a kind of a decent hint that, in fact, the story was possibly true. The second thing that made me think their story was true was there were several of them witnessed a UFO drop a piece of metal from the craft about 50 to 100 feet above them, right out into their driveway. And in fact, the metal, aluminum-like metal, hit the ground and was hot at this point and conformed to the gravel in the pavement there in their driveway. And that was interesting. And then, of course, we had it tested. What we found when we had it tested by university, and universities are generally where I prefer to do testing because they're impartial, and if they can debunk it, they certainly will. And that's what I prefer. And what they found was that not only this, but two other piece of samples I've had from two other UFOs are apparently of the same type of aluminum, which is a manufactured metal. And second is that there were high levels of strontium and other elements in it that you can't go down to the store and buy some strontium and put it to make your own aluminum and just stick some strontium in there and it'll all be fine. It doesn't happen like that. So this was a second good point that I got from them.
Daryl, let me ask one quick question regarding like the radiation levels and such. What type of radiation do they look for? And again, pardon my ignorance because I'm not a scientist. I know I look insanely intelligent, but I'm just not, Daryl. I'm a humble man. What kind of radiation are we looking for when we seek this? And is it radiation that would not be natural to that area? Would it be high spiked levels in a condensed area that wouldn't make sense? What specifically do we seek when we're looking for that?
Well, when we had a radiation detector in the area where they reported the shooting taking place, my thinking was that that craft has actually been in outer space. There's a possibility, depending on where it was and where it went, that there might be some traces of radiation on the craft itself.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true and they actually did shoot the thing, this goof may have literally gotten evidence he didn't know about. And so what we found were radioactive traces inside the BBs, where the BBs were buried up into the tree. This was quite pronounced enough that we could detect that there was, in fact, a radioactive trace there.
Now, are you able to take that type of radiation trace and say, look, this is from the Von Ryan belt. This is the exact type of radiation that surrounds the Earth that it would have to penetrate through this radiation belt to reach us? Or is it more of a, again, our skies are being constantly bombarded with different forms of radiation anyway. Is it something that's through our own atmosphere that you're picking up on?
In this case, we don't know, simply because the TV show that was hiring me to do the investigations certainly wasn't going to spend $100,000 to find out what kind of radiation or where it may have come from. Their biggest concern was that number one, they were shocked that there was a radioactive trace there in these BBs, and that where would radioactive trace come from BBs unless it in fact had hit something that had radioactive material on it. So that's where we left that.
Okay.
The better news was the UFO, the slag, the aluminum-like slag that was dropped out of the UFO that was, it was very hot when it hit the ground, and with cool, it was warm, not harmful, it didn't burn anybody. When they went over and touched that thing, finally, it did not burn anybody. This was quite remarkable. And this metal has been tested against other metals, and other labs from Los Alamos to other labs. And the amazing thing about it is, like I said, some of these rare elements that you find, you don't find, you can't go to the store and buy strontium and other levels of material like this and certainly not be able to find it and put it inside an aluminum flag. And for this to show up in other cases that have got UFO slag as well, some of them from as far back as 40, nearly 50 years ago, and it's still the same. It's the same metal, so to speak. So that was kind of important for me from a physical point. But there's a third type of material that is fascinating. It's when the alien physically touches people, when they literally handle you, they leave two types of traces on the individual, on the abductee or contactee, when they physically touch them. And if you can get a black light at a certain nanometer length to check them within 12 to 24 hours of their event, they'll glow like a Christmas tree. You'll see the long, slender finger marks and or the procedural markings on these people. And this fluorescence that you see on these people, it's a specific coloration, a specific nanometer length. You're not going to be able to fake it, in other words. And the most important thing is that this particular fluorescence that shows up on these people penetrates your skin subdermally on contact. In other words, you can't wash it off, get it off. You can't sand it off. You just get brighter.
Well, Daryl, if it's leaving that kind of traceable marking, I would think that would be a measurable form, especially if just being in brief contact with them can leave that type of trace evidence. If that's the case, and again, I'm going off of what I watch on TV and movies, and maybe it's just hyped, but dealing with the CIA, if that's the case and we can trace what type of element that is, what type of radiation that is. Can we not somehow calibrate instruments that would be able to pick up those more concentrated levels to be able to find aliens walking among us or the craft hovering above us? I would think that there would be something to use to do that with. Or maybe that's, again, just TV and movie fodder.
You're making a brilliant assessment, in my opinion. And it's an investigative mind that you have, and it's a good thought process. The obvious thing that I look for when I go to these conferences and stuff is when people claim contact, which many of these people, this was weeks ago. This stuff will disappear within usually a 24-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
The body will simply absorb it. But if I can get to them in time, I take trace samples of this and literally take skin samples, subdermal a sample, and then keep traces of this material. And obviously we have about 15 samples so far, and we want to have them tested. Some of these tests they're not cheap, and I pay for this stuff out of my pocket when I do get things done. And some of these tests are $14,000 a piece.
Wow.
They are not cheap to do.
Hmm. Understandable. Sure. I would think, you know, for proof, there's enough independent sources out there. You've got people like Dan Aykroyd, who is fascinated by this. I would think to prove the existence of some of these craft and these beings that there would be a big enough pool of hidden advisors and money that would be willing to be poured into these situations to actually seek this kind of knowledge and proof of the concept that this is really going on.
Okay. To answer your question succinctly in two areas, the answer is that is yes, sometimes. And one of the sometimes was I did the first two public surgeries on the so-called alleged alien implants,
mm-hmm.
one in a man's hand and three in a lady's on the top of her feet, not in her bottom of her feet where she stepped on something. And long story short, we did the medical evaluations on these people and found that there was no evidence to support that these were splinters or metal shards or something that they stepped on or did whatever. They were not natural to the body, and there were other witnesses that corroborated the information. One doctor looked at the three objects in the lady's foot and said, "Well, these are surgical clips, in my opinion, from an osteotomy." She said, "Well, the only problem with that is I've never had a surgery in my life." And I checked with the doctor and others, and no surgery. So we did operation on these two people, removed the objects. Later, I was confronted by a group called NIDS, or the National Institute for Discovery Science, mm-hmm. Which is Bob Bigelow outfit,
right.
When it was in operation years ago. And he came and asked me to come out to one of my doctors, go out to their compound there and speak to 18 scientists, which number of UFO people are there to try to get money from them for their research or whatever. And we were the only one accepted that day. And he was quite excited. And he says, isn't this great? And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, Daryl, this is great. They all wanted you to pick out the certain implants that you want tested, and we're going to pay for it, and we're going to send it. And I said, the only way I want to do that is two ways. I want it to be independent of me. I don't want to know where, what, so to speak. I want it a closed study. I don't want to, I can't be involved in it in any way, shape or form. And they can't know what the material is. They can't know where it came from. And they agreed to this. And, so they paid $22,000 for the study, which started at Los Alamos, and Los Alamos did a quantitative analysis, and they built a special microscope to fire a little tiny laser at the metal implants. And it would take the gas from that and transport it and evaluate it, and they would be able to tell a lot more about the little metal shards that were inside the lady's foot, as an example. What they found were 11 different elements that made no sense whatsoever to be on this particular metal. The reason that metal was weird and odd to begin with was that the metal was from a rare meteorite from the Wittmannstein or the Yautzung meteorite in outer space.
Mm.
What's it doing inside a human being?
Right.
Number two, the biology I didn't tell them about because, again, these are two impossible scenarios. Number one, the meteorites don't, and rare meteorites don't end up in people, period. Not three of them, especially in one location. And number two, the biology was impossible. What happened is these three implanted objects in this lady were wrapped in her own skin, a keratinous material. What that simply means to your audience is keratin shows up on the outside of the body. It's hair, fingernails, and surface skin.
Right.
It never appears anywhere near bone. It's not going to be there. It doesn't happen. And as the pathologist said, that couldn't have happened. He said, but I said, but you're looking at it. He said, well, that's a keratinous material membrane. He said, but that had to be on the outside of the body. I said, but it was, I have a video of it being surgically removed by two surgeons in front of 17 witnesses and an attorney. He said, I don't care where you found it. He said, it didn't happen. There's no such thing as a keratinous material coming from deep inside the body next to the bone. It doesn't happen. It can't happen.
Daryl, let me ask
so
you a question
that was
with
our
that.
First impossible one.
All right. Let me ask you a quick question about that. Now, the body works in remarkable ways. We know this to be true. We know that the body will take impurities and poisons and toxins and try to work them out. Could it be, just curiosity-wise, could it be that some of these people ingested in their local area food, water, anything like that that may have been tainted by the chemical compounds from this meteorite? And what happens is as the body processes it, and it's something that it cannot use, it cannot process through normal means, perhaps it tries to push it out of the body by combining it. And then in a protective sense, much like when our bodies ingest a disease, the white antibodies go to work on it. They'll surround it and try to defeat it. Could the keratin be a way that it's trying to shell this foreign body to help expel it through the skin, get it to a safe distance away from the heart, something along those lines, because most of them are found in feet or hands and seem to be trying to be, you know, farthest extremity from where it came. Could there be any chance that that's just a really amazing feature of our body trying to expel an impurity that has been formed into something that seems foreign?
Well, that makes sense, except for the fact that Los Alamos was so stunned with what they found and the elements surrounding these objects. They don't know anything about the biology. We never told them.
Mm-hmm.
Then they forwarded all this data and the implants over to New Mexico Tech to do a qualitative analysis. And what they found was even stranger. And they were just stunned at this whole, and they can't pick up. They said, where in the world did you get this rare needle-like projection from these meteorites? Where in the world did you find these? And of course, when the story came out from inside the human body, they ran for cover. I mean, they were, that's impossible. It can't happen, and it didn't happen. Well, the only problem is we got a video of the whole thing being done, showing the surgery removal. So the answer to your question is, what happens in the cases of where a metal or an object like that or something foreign to the human body happens inside someone? It's called a spatter effect from a hand grenade or something like that. A little metal shard gets in somebody. What will happen is these little cells will all gather around it like little phagocytes, and they will literally join hands, so to speak, and wall it off and make and hide it, so to speak, from the body to protect the body from it. The problem is that's called an inflammatory response. In other words, as soon as you remove that, like a piece of metal with the biological covering like that, like from a Vietnam veteran, where he got a metal shard from a bullet or something that blasted into his body. You pull that out, you take the membrane off of it, it's called an inflammatory response. The reason the biologist was so upset when we told him this came from inside human body, he said, that's not possible. This is not an inflammatory process surrounding the object. Mm-hmm. He said, this is in fact keratin. This is surface material. This never appears inside. There's no such creature. It never happened. It can't happen. And it didn't happen. He was emphatic about that. So what we have here is a walled off area, but it's not an inflammatory, it's not a result of an inflammatory process. In other words, it was done on purpose. We suspect that the scoop marks that these abductees report on their bodies, that's the surface skin that shows up there. that may in fact have been used to wrap and wall off the object, the implant, so that the body would not recognize it, because now it's wrapped in the person's own skin.
It's cloaking biology. Right, it's cloaking it, is what you're saying, so that it takes a piece of our own DNA to wrap around it so that our body does not reject it and try to refuse it or push it out.
The reason that was fascinating to me is mm-hmm. that I was talking to a Nobel laureate one day, and he said, Mr. Sims, having read your report and looking at this, he said, I am rather stunned. And I said, what do you find interesting about it? And he says, well, he said, if that is a non-inflammatory process, he said, it's just beyond remarkable. He said, here's why. He said, if you could replicate this non-inflammatory process in a laboratory, you may have a Nobel laureate find. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, organ donor rejection may be passé at this point, if you can replicate that process in the lab. He said, your pathologist is correct. It doesn't happen. And for you to have a sample of it where it did, he said, well, you may be looking at technology here that we never believed possible.
All right. So you've got these samples. Once they're removed from the body, they're tested scientifically. What is the principles we find out about them? Are they microchipped? Are they putting off any kind of measurable readings? Anything that we can determine what it is aside from being an alien splinter of some sort?
Sure. To do this even better, we'll go back 1 year before I discovered the implants, before we did any surgical removals of any so-called possible alleged alien implants. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking at John Muir Medical Hospital for 250 surgeons in an AMA-sponsored program on medical complications of alleged human alien contact. This is a straight-laced, high-class, high-dollar, million-dollar complex. Just the room I was speaking is a million-dollar complex.
Wow.
Just for their continuing education. And they're having me speak on these alleged implants that I'm finding and have found since the early, during the 1980s. And I told them, I said, if in fact these implants are real, if they're real, if in fact what we have here is valid and it's alien, so to speak, not just a shard of metal or not this or whatever, what we think is going to happen is that, I said, there are four things that I think that are going to be true if these are alien in origin. I said, the first one is that there will be no signs of inflammatory response. Notice the statement I made. No signs of inflammatory response. In other words, if that thing is cocooned, it's not due to a war injury or something like that. It's quite unique. It will have this impossible membrane around it. Number two is that the object will in fact be attached to a nerve supply. And number three, and very important, is in fact that these objects will have no discernible form of technology. If, in fact, we find implants or objects that are like an RFID chip, something like that, the clear thing that will be obvious about that is that there will be a human form of technology there, and it will be discernible, and it will probably be obtainable. You'd be able to find out where the manufacturer was, so to speak. None of those things, all the things I predicted there came to pass. Even the two surgeons were saying, how in God's name would you know that before you ever did a surgery? It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
I said, because I was there in the event. I know what happened to me. I said, because this implantation occurred to me in 1960 when I was 12 years old. That's why I know so much about it.
When you, you say you've got this implant inside of you. What, can you explain this to me? Do you have a memory of that occurring? How did you know it was from that time? What was that like?
The event was another one of these events. I didn't make any, never chained this together, never made sense out of any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just one of these bizarre, strange things that happen that you want to put out of your mind. You never want to remember it again. And it is in Alamogordo, New Mexico. I lived on 1305 Ohio Street. And in this place, long story short, is I sense something, and I'm instantly awake. And I'm laying in bed, and I'm like, weird. And I can hear my mother's voice, and she's calling. And none of this makes sense because they're in the other end of the house. I couldn't hear her if she was yelling. And I can hear her as clear as a bell. Somebody's mimicking her voice, in other words, or using her voice, and saying, Daryl, go outside. Well, first of all, I don't get up and walk outside when it's freezing. It's cold out there.
Right.
It's close to winter. I'm not going outside. You know, it's desert in New Mexico, and it's cold anyway at night out there in the desert. So, and she says there's a new star, and she mentions the word Pentine, and which is weird because there's no such thing that I know of, and I know exactly what that is. So I go outside, and as soon as I go outside, I see this large, bright light on the horizon, and I mean it is huge, and there's the moon up there. There's Venus. I mean, bright in the sky. It's clear night, beautiful night, but there's this huge bright light on the horizon. And I'm thinking, well, what in the world is that? And all of a sudden, this bright light comes across the desert very, very rapidly. And the next thing I know, I'm and I hate to use this illustration. If you ever saw the movie Phenomenon,
right.
Where the guy was looking up in the sky, and a bright light, boom, next thing he knows, he's laying on the ground. He can't figure out what happened to him.
Exactly.
Well, that happened to me, but I'm inside this circular room at this point, and there's the same cosmic skinhead over there that always picked me up, and there is somebody taller than he is that he's talking to, and this is all mental, of course, and I'm listening to them, and I finally begin to cry because I realize what they're going to do to me. And they pull out this long needle-like device about 8-9 inches long. And it's got a little silver sphere on the end of it. And they inserted my nasal passage and jammed it in there and broke the bones in my nose.
Oh.
And it went back behind my eyes, excruciating pain.
I bet.
There was no anesthesia whatsoever. None. Oh. I mean, it's very easy to remember because it hurt.
Yeah.
And when the needle came back out, there was blood on the end of it, and the little sphere was gone. So that's the last. Next morning, I'm in bed, and there's blood on my pillow, and my mom looks at me and says, "Have you been picking your nose?" I said, yeah, because, I mean, I didn't know what to say. Because, I mean, why is there blood on your pillow? Mm-hmm. Well, it's obviously from a nosebleed. Question is, where'd the nosebleed come from? No, I have not been picking my nose. So I'm rather stunned. I didn't know what to say, so I'm just lying to her. You know, I just, sure, I shouldn't have been picking my nose. And so that ended that. But the point is that I'd never had a clue why they did what they did or what that meant until later when I started doing my investigations. Obviously had a body scan and other things, and I found no evidence. They'd obviously come back and removed it. But I have gone to the VA hospital on 2 occasions as a veteran, and doctors have been rather stunned at what they found independent of me and knew nothing about my UFO events until I finally told them. And one of them was this. Well, the doctor came in one day and said, "How you feeling?" I said, my primary care physician, I said, just fine. And he said, "Well, I feel like I got a little pain over here." And he said, "No, the pain's on the other side." And I said, "You don't know where my pain is at. You're not some kind of psychic or something." And he said, "Your pain is over here." And I said, "No, it's not. The little pain is over here." And he said, "No, it can't be." He said, "Your broken ribs are on the other side." I said, "I don't have any broken ribs. What are you talking about?" He pulls out my x-rays, and there the broken ribs are healed up. I said, "If you have broken ribs, you know that. You can barely move. You can barely talk.
You can barely breathe. Yeah.
Yeah. How would you get them healed overnight without knowing it?" So that was another event that I had. And they said, "Well, the lady told me," said, "then you had a positive event. They healed you up." I said, "No, ma'am, you missed the whole point. They healed me up to cover up the injury. They didn't want me to know. My doctor found it out independent of me." And a neurologist called me later about some other cases, and she told me she said a number of your abductees are my patients. I said, "Well, that's fascinating. I didn't know that." And she said, "The question I have for you is, have you found or do you suspect injury to these people beyond their natural accidents like car accidents and so on?" I said, yes, I do. And she said, do you think that they use car injuries and things like this to hide what they've done? I said, yes, I do. And she said, I have medical evidence to absolutely support that point of view. I wrote a paper called Them Bones, and that's the, and my case is in there as well. But I've got two cases where the VA has already proven this in their own independent investigation, and they knew nothing about UFOs. I never told them until later.
Now, was there anything interesting, aside from the fact that you had broken ribs you knew nothing about, was there anything interesting about the way they were broken? Was it a clean break? Was it laser point? I mean, there had to have been some kind of characteristic to that damage that, you know, was it internal, you know, explosion or an external blow that caused those ribs to break?
External blow.
Okay. To what extent? Do you have any idea why they would, what they would have done?
I do, and I've never told anybody why.
Okay.
I do know more, a lot more about the story, and the reason I believe my version of it is because there are two independent witnesses. Both are younger than I am and were not alive when my event happened, and they know the details of it as good or better than I do. They were shown this by their alien captors and told not for them not to give me any more information about their case and so on. But they were shown what happened to me. And I'm sitting there, they're telling me what happened to me when I was 17 years old. They weren't even born then, you know. That you can't make this stuff up because I haven't told anybody.
Why would the aliens?
No, because I haven't told you.
Right. Why would the aliens impart that information on others?
I think in these two cases, these are only two people that knew. The purpose was, in my view, and it's a long involved story, but I'll just make it as short as possible, was to alert me that others knew about my event and for me to keep my big mouth shut. And number two is for them to know that there is danger involved here, and that if you don't want this kind of stuff to happen to you, maybe you ought to just keep your mouth shut.
Wouldn't it just be a lot safer for them, instead of involving more people that could go rogue? Wouldn't it be more impactful to just pull Daryl Sims up and say, listen, this is what's gone on. We've done these things to you. And if you continue to share or give this information out, you're just going to vanish someday. There just will be no memory of Daryl Sims.
Well, that would make sense to me, having been in the intelligence community and in the military before. That would make a lot of sense.
Right.
To get rid of the problem.
Right. Instead of spreading.
For whatever reason known to them, and I don't know what it is, that didn't happen. And we do have rare cases, and I do in my own files, rare cases of people that are, you've heard of these cattle mutilations as an example, or sheep mutilations and this sort of thing. Well, we've got human mutilations too. They're very rare, but they do happen, and they are definitely beyond the pale in terms of somebody didn't do it. Somebody didn't, the local Jack the Ripper didn't go out and do this, so to speak.
What are you looking for when people have implants? Is there a specific set of things? You mentioned the scooping of the skin. First of all, explain that a little bit more clearly, if you would, so people understand what to look for. And then,
sure.
B, are there any natural artifacts of our own health that could cause that same indentation?
The scoop that you find on abductees are rather interesting. They look like a dermatological punch. And if you could take just a little tiny, tiny, tiny spoon and scoop out an area of their skin and then cauterize it rapidly, that's what it would look like. And you say, well, that could be done for whatever reason. So, sure, things can happen like that. What is consistent, though, with a reasonable amount of these abductees, that they have these scooped out areas, and I have one on my shin. I remember when I got it. Remember I told you the night they took me, the second night?
Right.
The two of them were standing there at the end of the bed. The next morning, I'm in my little shorts wandering around outside playing, and I look down and notice this big, huge scoop mark on my shin bone. Well, the reason that is rather bizarre to me is that little kids, if they get injured, they have scabs. And if they have scabs, they pick at them. That's what little kids do.
Right.
They just do.
And I know a lot of big kids that do that, too.
Yeah. There's no scab. How in the world do I have a my little legs are probably at 4 years old, are probably about an inch and a half thick. I mean, I'm a scrawny little guy anyway. And there's this 5/8 of an inch scoop mark on my shin bone. It doesn't make any sense. And as I'm touching that scoop mark and I'm pushing my finger in it and trying to figure out, you know, how to, it's like a little valley in there. How does that happen? I'm trying to figure this stuff out. As I push on it, I heard this voice. And this will go to the psych. The psych people are going to love this one. I heard this voice as I began touching, playing. I kept asking the question, how did that happen? And a voice said, you fell and hurt yourself. The only problem with that, you saying, well, that's you. That's just you talking to yourself. I never talk to myself in second person.
Mm-hmm.
Never. Never have. That's an implanted thought from someone else to keep you from digging any further, so to speak, into your events. But I've got one abductee. It's got 7 scoop marks in a row right down his shin. I mean, one after another, bang, 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 bang. I have 7 of them, equally spaced, inch and a half apart. And a cardiovascular surgeon, a famous cardiovascular surgeon out of Santa Monica, did the surgeries on that one for me. But scoop marks are just a hint. And the fact is, we've also analyzed the scoop marks, and inside the scoop marks, they seem to have a condition called solar elastosis, which basically means that they were cauterized with a intense ultraviolet light. So the question is, how does a 4-year-old kid scoop a huge scoop mark 5/8 of an inch out of his shin bone in Midland, Texas, in 1952, and then cauterize it with some type of a remarkable device like that? I haven't the slightest clue. I'm open to all kinds of answers. I just hadn't figured that out yet.
These implants, do you side-by-side comparison them to each other? Are any of them identical to other implants, or does each one seem to be its own unique
Many of the structure? Implants appear to be different.
Mm-hmm.
That's rather remarkable. We've got an ocular implant fell out of a lady's eye after a mass abduction of 11 people in 2 cities and two states and several cities, starting in Houston, Texas. And the implant fell out of her eye in front of her boss at work the next morning. And her boss made her bring that to me. She was going to sweep it off into the carpet and said, it's just a grain of sand or something that's been bothering me all night. And her boss put it in a little container, gave it to her and said, if you don't take it to that UFO guy that you introduced me to the other day, Mr. Sims, I'm going to fire you. She said, because I remembered you said that abductees destroy their own evidence all the time. I said, they do. Like she was going to sweep it off in the carpet. They will never bring you their evidence. You have to. The evidence I have in my case, my box that I have a pull of this material, that's 38 years of work. There should be tons of it. There isn't, because they destroy most of their own evidence. They will never come forward unless you practically force them or coerce them to do it. The few implants that I have found that are reasonably consistent,
right,
are the little silver spheres that I talked about, the one that ended up in my nasal passage. Now, a man came to me several years ago, and he said, I've got an implant back behind my eye just like you did. And I said, I think you probably heard me on a radio show or something, or TV, and you just made that up. You're just trying to mimic my situation. I said, people do that. And he says, no, sir. He said, I'll send you the x-rays. And he did. It's in the exact same position, exact same place. And it's the bright sphere is right there, and he's right there behind his eye near in his brain. And his doctors can't figure out how it got there because there's no damage, no trauma, how it could have been like a bullet or a piece of a metal shard blown up and going in his head. It just is there. And there's no trauma to how it got there. And I said, don't ever mention alien implants or anything. Just let them handle it.
And did he get it removed?
No, it's inside the brain. You wouldn't want to do something like that. Some of these objects are one implant. Let me give an example. One implant I have here in this lady's chest, and she's in the military, her husband is, and the implant is in her chest in between her lung and her heart. The thing is the size of a walnut. I have no idea what that thing is. Their doctor said it's not a tumor. not, it's solid, whatever it is. And he said, obviously, we'd never remove it because it, you know, it would endanger life. We're never going to do anything like that. So this was kind of a shocker too. So we've got different size of these objects as well. So we're just, and the real question though is of implants. Let me say this for your audience, because I don't like people being scared stuff like this for no reason. Implants are very rare, and if you are an abductee and you think you have an implant, 99.99% of the time you don't. It's a normal object, or it's an unusual object that got inside you that has nothing to do with aliens. Most of the x-rays that I look at several hundred a year. Most of the x-rays I look at are not alien implants. They're just stuff, and weird stuff happens to people. The implants are vastly different, and there are different things that are associated with them that would tell us a lot more about it if they in fact were.
Is there any kind of measurable effect of these implants, especially the ones that are in the brain? Are we able to pick up any kind of radio frequency from them? Are we able to pick up any kind of trace radiation? Is there anything to them other than just this dormant sliver?
Well, what we found about it is that, number one, we haven't found any quote-unquote signals from the ship to there or anything like that. Mm-hmm. What we have found is that these objects, by my definition, are in fact intrusive. They are parasitical, in my view, and they function off of the host. And what I mean by that is that when you start evaluating these alleged abductees that have an implant, as an example, or some of this phenomena, what you find is that when you start having them to go to their neurologist and get checked out, is you find that some of them have altered levels of serotonin and dopamine and potassium. What does that mean? Well, as a neuropsychologist told me one day, she says, "Mr. Sims, if your findings here are accurate," this is horrifying. She's what you have here. Anyone that can control your neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine is an example. She said, they own you. They decide whether you're happy, sad, glad, upset, or whatever. They run your show. She said, it doesn't matter if it's your doctor or an alien. They're running your show. And I said, that's a fact. I concur with that.
All right. Are we finding people that have, I certainly don't want to break this down into getting into too deep into a conspiratorial way, but are we finding people like the Aurora, Colorado shooting suspect? Are we finding any of these people dealing with any kind of implants like this as well? Something that may be manipulated in order to trigger these effects and create violent outbursts?
Well, certainly, I am most interested in that sort of thing. And if I, in all the, I've done 25 surgeries. Well, the last one was in India. I just came back from there.
Okay.
Did a surgery there, removing an object from the lady. And I have not found anything, any quote-unquote alien, any human or manufacturer or government or any other kind of RFID chip or anything like that. If I did, I'd be screaming bloody murder, because nobody is about First Amendment and me, and that kind of information needs to be out to everybody. It's wrong, it's immoral, and I'm against that whole idea. So if I found anything like that, it would be on the internet overnight, and it would be studied by proper people, and we would be screaming at the height of our voice and then trying to find out who made it and why it's there. There is only one story I know of a lady who they found an RFID chip in her. That's the story, and I'm looking to verify it now, but the report was that they had a RFID chip inside her. And so I'm looking to see if that's in fact true, number one, and number two, who made it? Because if that's an RFID chip, it's manufactured. It's that simple. Alien implants are not made or manufactured on Earth at all, and many of them will in fact have an extraterrestrial signature. The human implants will not.
All right. I'm curious too, having been a former military police officer and a CIA operative, and being as vocal about this as you are, do you or have you had visits from men in black, from government agencies trying to shut you up about this, Daryl?
I have not, and I'm very open about that. I mean, if somebody's messing with me or something like that, I'm going to be very clear about that. I can tell you two quick stories that are fascinating that were relayed to me. One of them, I went on a radio program years ago, many years ago, and I made a plea for a webmaster to help us, and a guy called me in Houston and said, I'd like to meet with you and I'd like to do some web work for you. And I said, okay. And I took my wife with me and we were sitting there outside a restaurant and we were talking. He kept looking at me, looking at her, looking at me, looking at her. And I said, what? And he says, I'm not sure we should discuss this in front of your wife. And I said, you can discuss anything. It's okay. And he said, I don't really think you should. And finally I said, just spit it out. He looks, leans forward, looks at me, and he says, they're watching you. And I said, who is they? He said, I think you know who they are. The people you used to work for. And I said, how do you know that? And he said, well, he said, I've already looked at your site and checked it out. And he said, they're parked there. I said, I haven't posted anything in years. And he said, that's a good idea. And he said, I just wanted you to know that they're parked there. If you ever do publish anything, they'll be the first to get it.
Wow.
I thought that was amusing. And and he looked at me and said, and Doris kept saying, who's parked where? And I explained it to her. And he finally looked at me and said, Mr. Sims, he said, as much as I believe in you and love what you do, he said, what you do scares me half to death. And he said, I want to retract my offer.
Wow.
I don't need that kind. I don't need that kind of attention.
Sure.
Second story, hand to God, true story. Later got a webmaster who was a former cryptologist. Really wonderful guy. And I went on this major show and I said, I just dropped a few buzzwords that we used back when I was in the company.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see if anybody's listening out.
Sure.
There. And this was, it's just an experiment. I never told anybody anything. The next morning, I mean to tell you, my webmaster called me. He cussed me out from one. I said, don't you talk to me like that. Don't you cuss me out. He said, what in the blanket are you doing? He said, we had 250 hits on the website last night. I said, we had a lot more hits than that. And he said, I'm talking about from the intelligence community. He said, we had 250 hits and said three of them were from NSA computers inside the White House. Stop it.
Wow.
Whatever you think you're doing, stop it.
You think those would be blocked. You would think those would be blocked a little bit better. Yeah. You think that.
Oh, he was bent out of shape.
You would think that would be blocked a little bit better.
The last thing I can give you that I think your audience might be interested in
sure.
is this. I have not been threatened, but two of my abductees were.
Okay.
And the mistake that the when I say MIB, I mean men in black government guy, not alien.
Right.
There are two kinds. And the government types are, these are super secretive people, and they are, for lack of a better term, above black operations.
Okay.
They're not accountable to you or anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to find them. So one of them came to one of my abductees' homes. And he said, guy scared me half to death. He said, he knew more about me than I knew about myself. I said, of course he does. And he warned me not to tell anybody anything. Sound like the alien. Not to tell Daryl anything. Not to give him any information whatsoever. He said, he quoted me a certain law that he says, a certain regulation. He says, you can go to prison, blah, 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 if you even discuss this conversation with anybody. And he said, Daryl, he made a mistake. And I said, what's that? And he said, he gave me his business card. I said, oh, my.
Hmm.
Thank you for that. And I got it. And as a private investigator and former cop, I went after that with a meat hook. I couldn't find who he was, where he was, what he did, nothing about him. And I went all the way up. I I'll just tell you this. I had to go way outside my pay grade and past where I was ever at to find anything. And what I found was, in fact, this agency, this group of people does exist. And I don't care what anybody says, and this is not political at all. Every president since Truman signed off on this particular group to do these investigations mm-hmm. about UFOs and on these abductees. And in fact, President Obama signed off on it last. So when they stand there and tell me I don't know anything about anything, I think you do.
Do you believe that these are beings from other planets, other dimensions, or are they beings that coexist with us here on Earth at all times, and we're just we're part of their petri dish? We're part of their experimental, program.
I think that's a great question, and I would like to answer it in a very interesting way. I think whoever they are, let's assume they come from other planets. I don't think that's the case, but let's assume that.
Mm-hmm.
Or way out there, wherever it is, other dimensions, whatever the model you want to use. I think somebody has come a long, long way to get whatever it is you and I have for themselves. And the fact is that you are unique in the entire universe. And a reasonable proof of that is, why in the world would they select this little tiny blue marble to come all the way here and spend thousands of hours, thousands of even years to do what they're doing with us? When the fact is, I thought they were all powerful, all knowing, and all everything. They're going to fix the ozone hole, fix the planet, and do all this. They're not here to do any of that. They're not interested in any of it. They're not trying to boil us in oil. They're not going to eat us. They're not going to do any of that. That's not what they're interested in. They're very surreptitious, very private about it, very secretive. In my opinion, probably the lower-level so-called alien doesn't have a clue. They're only doing their job. They don't know why. They don't know what its ultimate purpose is for, only that they're working for someone else that's much bigger.
Do you ever get
and
the
yes,
feeling—
I think the government knows about that.
Do you ever get the feeling that what we are is a war games scenario for an alien race, that they keep putting us— because I'll tell you— Daryl, and again, not meaning to seem like I'm going down too many rabbit holes here, but it sure seems like our world and our country is put into some really bizarre situations, almost like, let's see what happens next. You know, the old Alan Funt hidden camera shows, right? Let's put this person in charge. Let's start this issue over here. Let's bomb these buildings and see how they react. Almost like they're doing a predictive session to see how it would happen, what would happen for their own planet or their own situation. Because some of these experiences we have here on our little blue marble seem contrived and really weird. And you see people that are numb to certain situations when they should be reacting and they should be incensed. And again, I have no political agenda to push here, but it just seems that there are things that take place that we have no reaction to, and then there are the smallest, silliest things that we overreact to. And I don't know. I feel like we're definitely some type of weird experiment.
Well, I think you're wiser than your years to point this out. And all I can say in reference to that is simply this. In my humble opinion, there are governments, and there are black operations inside governments, and then there are corporations that are bigger than governments and that fall outside governments. The governments are part of their program, so to speak. And they're so big that they're beyond black operations themselves. They can do anything they basically choose to. They're credentialed. They can be anywhere they need to be, and they'll be credentialed. And there's not anything anybody can do about it. And I don't know. I'm not a conspiracist. I don't lay awake wondering who killed President Kennedy and the Kennedys. I don't do that. I'm not interested. You figured it out, call me and tell me. But don't waste 40 years of my life trying to tell me that. My point is that I know enough about where I've been and what I've done in my life to know that this thing is much bigger than we imagine, and that the UFO phenomena is part and parcel to it. But the fact is, these people on the planet, quote unquote, that are running the big stuff, and I mean big, and that includes nations, they can't control the alien any more than anybody else can. Whatever the alien is, whoever the alien is in ancient times, they still are. They've covered their tracks in every generation. To the Islamic people, they were the jinn of Islam. They were the fairy people, the wee fairy folk that'll take you away if you don't do right, and so on. All through the nations, everybody's got a different take on these beings, but they're the same beings in every generation, everywhere, every time. And do they interfere with governments? Of course they do. Alexander the Great himself was conquering a city, couldn't get past this great wall. And his UFOs come down and blast the wall, knock it down so that his army can go on in there. Sounds political to me. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what to say about it other than it's weird, it's big, and it's out there. And I think we have as much interest. We better have an interest in this from a political point of view, from a personal point of view, and from a spiritual point of view. I think if you ignore any of those three, you're blind.
At the beginning of the show, I brought up Whitley Strieber. And I want to bookend the show with this as we've got about 10 minutes left together here. I brought up the fact that his story has changed dramatically over the years. Then I've heard abductees like Travis Walton from Fire in the Sky, who remain steadfast to their story. And although they've come to terms with it, do not seem compassionate or forgiving or friendly now with those beings, but more, you know, just this is life. This is the normal that I know. When you talk to abductees and these people, do you find that there is some level of Stockholm syndrome going on where they are just complacent about it because, A, there's nothing they can do about it, or, B, they've grown compassionate to their abductor's will?
Or, C, they're programmed. The answer to your question is yes. Abductors, two primary groups in the UFO phenomenon. One is called abductees. Abductees are people who were taken against their will, abducted. It's illegal. It's immoral. And they know it, and they don't like it. And I'm one of them. People always say, but don't you think there are good aliens like bad people and good people? I said, no, let's change it into the term it's supposed to be. Do I think there are good kidnappers and bad kidnappers out there? No, I don't. That's when I involved myself in a kidnapping case. Parents never come to me and say, oh, thank you for catching that wonderful kidnapper that took our child.
Right.
I never hear this from people. And yet I hear it from people that are contactees all the time. Abductees are like killer bees to me. If you steal their honey, I guarantee you're going to pay the price. However, if you go to a honeybee and you put on the right little suit, large black eyes, white little suit, protect yourself, come in there, you can steal all the honey you want, and they'll produce all the honey you need. They don't mind. In fact, they think you're supposed to be stealing it.
That's called
programming.
What do you make of Stan Romanek, of Whitley Strieber, of Travis Walton, of names like that have really captured a lot of people's attention and imagination in this field? Are there any, and you don't have to give me the name of the specific one, but I mean, are there any that you look at that you say this is complete and utter nonsense and this did not happen? And on other cases,
I do not believe in the much in the one case, because the guy was caught with some. I mean, anybody with half a brain get out there and investigate and see one individual was flat. He was fudging. He was definitely faking some stuff. Travis Walton, I know personally. I like him. He's a good guy. He has not changed his story. I think he's come to grips with it in an interesting way. And then Whitley Strieber, I know him as well for a long time back. I think he is probably, I think he's a good science fiction writer is what I think. I think he knows how to spin that paper pretty well. I find it curious that one day he thinks they're here to save the planet, fix those on hold. Another day he thinks they're angels. The next day he writes another book, you know, he'd stick his thumb in the wind and gets another breeze, and the breeze is they're here to save us, so he writes books on that. And then that doesn't work for a while, and he wants to scare people, so he writes books on information on, you know, well, you know, we better watch out, you know, they're going to do terrible things to us like they did to me, and that sort of thing, you know. So I think he's an opportunist, in my opinion.
All right. Well, we appreciate.
I think his events may have been quite real, but I think he's the rest of it. I think he just reads into it
and it manipulates it to what he needs at the time.
Books.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry. I know the guy. I'm sorry. Sure. That's just
and that's Daryl's position. That's why I said Tim and I have been confused by it because he's waffled on our show on air about what's gone on. And I have a lot of respect for the man, and I think he's fascinating. But I've often wondered just what you were saying. Is this man a science fiction writer with a vividly imaginative experience that you know, there's a kernel of truth and the rest is kind of whatever hits the flow at that time? Well, Daryl, we're up against the end of the show here. Fascinating. Would you please come back and share more information and research with us as time progresses? We'd love to have you back.
Sure, I'd love to. And I love your program. You're very, very sharp. Both of you are excellent and thoroughly enjoyed your program.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And thank you all for tuning in. This week, we've got some other great topics. We're going to take a scientific look at ghosts. What is a ghost? What is a spirit? And poltergeist activity. And a little later on this week, our good friend Dark Waters is back on Friday, and Dark's going to be bringing the stories. He's got his own Theater of the Mind stories to share with us when we return. That's what's going on this week on the best in paranormal talk radio. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. And that was Daryl Sims, our guest here on Beyond the Darkness.